Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And beginning this week's Triangle Business Journal comes the articles from the Biz page. There are three or four articles here, and one of them, of course, is on helping kids. The article is entitled, Execs Come Out for Holt Brothers Fundraising Event. You know what it means when they say we have pictures, right? Well, Biz got some at the annual Holt Brothers Foundation's An Intimate Evening of Music on August the 19th with Etienne Charles, a prolific trumpeter, and his band Creole Soul. From Trademark Properties' Billy Redmond to NC State University basketball legend Derek Wittenberg to UNC Rex Hospital CEO Steve Burris to the hosts themselves, Terrence and Tori Holt. Dancing was the theme of the evening. The Holt brothers raised $45,000 during the night, money that goes to support the brothers' two main programs, Kids Can and Camp Kesem. Kids Can is a program embraced by area hospitals to form support groups for children who have a parent with cancer. Camp Kesem is a sleepaway camp for children with a parent with cancer. The evening's cause may have been serious, but the mood was definitely light. All in the name of charity. And a bonus for Biz, we now have pictures, lots of them. And in the article Kids Shine comes the article Tomorrow's Entrepreneurs Showcase Their Skills. Talk about an impressive group of kids. Biz spent the morning of August 19th at the Triangle Children's Business Fair at Park West Village in Morrisville, meeting young entrepreneurs. The event featured kids from elementary school to high school, all showing off and selling their ideas and creations. There were baked goods, jewelry creations, dog biscuits, homemade yogurt, and special pillows for lost teeth. There was even a very lovely cool drink coaster that let off a lovely fragrance when heated. Hey, Biz is all about warm coffee and a fresh scent in the morning. The kids there demonstrated warm smiles and a cool sense of what it takes to make a profit. Always a key combination in business. Nice work, kids. See you on the NASDAQ in 2029, if it takes that long. And another news from the Biz page comes the article about a Canadian consul talking about NAFTA in the Triangle. With the future of NAFTA under discussion, Canada is looking to remind trading partners such as North Carolina about the deep ties between the two markets. Consul General Louise Blay, who is based in Atlanta, traveled to the Triangle this week for a meeting with Governor Roy Cooper and a chance to deepen ties with the region with visits to IBM and other places. According to figures from the Canadian government, Canada is the state's top foreign trade partner. Canadian trade contributes to 247,000 jobs in North Carolina, with the state exporting $6.3 billion to Canada in 2016, and Canada exporting $3.4 billion to the North Carolina that year. Canada brings in a very heavy dose of manufacturing products from the state, but Blay tells Biz that the shift she is seeing is toward technology. I'm looking to work with companies around the Research Triangle to boost opportunities on both sides of the border, she says. The gaming industry, for example, is high on her list of interests. It's not so much what we need as it is what can we do together, she said. As we move to the digital economy, things are shifting. It's a more complex environment to work in, as in, how can Canadian companies have opportunities when there is a virtual space? How do you work with players here, whether they are startups or younger tech companies? Part of my trip is actually scouting out those opportunities, she adds. And on the golf front comes the article, John Daly to Take a Swing at Triangle Seniors Event. The SAS Championship in Kerry has just added another big hitter to this year's tourney, two-time major champion John Daly. It marks Daly's first appearance at the SAS Championship since he joined the PGA Tour Champions in 2016. Having John Daly as part of the SAS Championship is exciting for our fans, who will get to see him up close at Prestonwood, tournament director Jeff Kleber said. He's one of the most well-known golfers in the world, and we are eager to add him to an already elite field of golfers. The SAS Championship is 24th on the tour schedule and has a total purse of $2.1 million. The tour is for professionals age 50 and older. Daily now sits 14th on its Charles Schwab Cup money list with $619,266,000 in earnings. His 2017 season is highlighted by a victory at the Insperity Invitational in May. He also leads the tour in driving distance at 299.99 yards per drive. Sounds like 300 yards to me. And finally, on the biz page comes the article, That's Racing. There's nothing like a friendly wager, especially when it comes to sports cars and governors. Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe and North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper are taking part in a friendly wager for the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship on August 25th through the 27th at the Virginia International Raceway. McAuliffe will be rooting for James Clay from Blacksburg, Virginia, while Cooper has selected the Ocean Isles' Chad McCombie. Whichever car finished higher in the race will determine the winner, who gets either a North Carolina or Virginia basket filled with agricultural products. Now from the On Real Estate page of this week's TVJ comes several articles. First is National Builder entering Holly Springs. The Carolinas Division of National Home Building Company Taylor Morrison Home Corp. has ambitious plans to grow its Triangle presence, starting with a major development in Holly Springs. Gray Shell, Raleigh Division President of Taylor Morrison, says the company will soon break ground on the first lots and houses at its new Bridgeberry community off Rex Road in Holly Springs, a three-phase project that will eventually have 338 homes on the 182-acre site. Taylor Morrison closed on the purchase of the land in June, paying $7.5 million for the wooded property, according to county deed records. The first homes should be ready by fall of 2018. Prices haven't been finalized, but Shell expects the community of single-family homes will be in the $300,000 and $400,000, a sweet spot for builders in western Wake County who have been scrambling to secure property rights as demand remains high. We want to break into the top 10 home builders in Raleigh this year and be in the top 5 by 2019, says Shell. In 2015, Arizona-based Taylor Morrison acquired about half of Orleans Home's portfolio of properties in the eastern U.S., including all of its land, lots, and houses in North Carolina. Much of Orleans land at the time was concentrated in Wake Forest, Apex, and Cary, and since the acquisition, the company has expanded to add new community plans in South Durham and eastern Chatham County. Taylor Morrison, in 2016, went halvesies with Ashton Woods Homes to begin development of a 144-unit neighborhood in Cary called Ridgefield Farms. And in real estate news from downtown, the New York Group buys BB&T Building in Durham. BB&T Bank has sold its five-story City Branch Building at 505 South Duke Street in downtown Durham to New York real estate investment group Hem Plus Spire. The firm's founder, Maxwell Joseph, says the building will soon be undergoing a substantial renovation. Joseph's company paid $1.3 million for the 32,500-square-foot building and 1.7-acre lot, which is about a 70% discount from the property's $4.3 million property tax value, according to Durham County's Tax Administration records. BB&T has signed a long-term lease contract to keep its branch office with about 40 employees on the building's bottom two floors, bank spokesperson David White confirms. Joseph says the plan is to find other office tenants to fill the remaining three floors once renovations are complete. We think it's a great space and a great location, he says. Joseph says they have no immediate plans to substantially change the site since BB&T wants to remain a tenant. Down the road, we probably would be interested in a development opportunity, he says. And in news from Raleigh comes the article, Waste Industries sold to group that includes the Poole family. Waste Industries, the Raleigh waste hauling company started nearly 50 years ago, is being sold as part of a 100% buyout deal with the company's controlling partners at Macquarie Infrastructure Partners, Chairman and CEO Vin Poole said. Macquarie helped orchestrate Waste Industries' management-led buyout of the company to take the publicly traded company private again in 2008, a deal that valued the company at $544 million at the time. Under the new agreement, Macquarie will cash out all of its controlling shares in the company. According to a news release, Waste Industries is being sold to a newly formed investor group that includes members of the Poole family, senior management in the company, and funds controlled by two national venture capital firms, Manhattan-based HPS Investment Partners and Chicago-based Equity Group Investments, founded by billionaire investor Sam Zell. HPS is a spinout of J.P. Morgan Asset Management that had $39 billion of assets under management as of March. Zell founded EGI nearly 50 years ago and invests in a variety of industries. No major changes are planned for Waste Industries' existing operations. Poole remains chairman and CEO under the new ownership structure. Poole has been with the company since 1990 and assumed the position of CEO in 2009 and chairman of the board in 2015. Thanks to an incredibly successful partnership with MIP over the last 9 years, we've been able to build a business that is attractive to a new generation of investors and complete this share capital reorganization with the absolute best possible outcome for our customers, our employees, and our company, Poole stated. Our new partners have already proven to be exceptional, and I look forward to maximizing the potential of Waste Industries together. Financial terms of the deal were not disclosed. And finally, on the On Real Estate page comes an article about a building in Durham. The article is entitled, Durham Building with Quirky History, Sold. Chapel Hill real estate investor Jay Miller has a soft spot for historic buildings, and his most recent acquisition in North Durham certainly has an interesting history. According to county records, Miller Property Management LLC purchased in early August the three-story Colonial Revival-style building at 2400 Broad Street, located about a half mile north of the Costco, for $1.18 million. The building currently serves as the offices for Durham Family Medicine and classrooms for Montessori Farm School. According to Preservation Durham Archives, the building was built around 1925 as a new jail for Durham County, but it was only used as a jail for about 5 years. The property sat vacant for several years until the early 1940s, when it was repurposed as a tuberculosis sanitarium. In the 1950s, the building was turned into a studio for WTVD-TV, which remained there until 1977, when the station moved downtown. Miller says he's not planning any other major changes to the historic Broad Street property right now. The first electric buses will soon hit the Triangle streets, and more could be coming. This from the On Transportation page. Raleigh-Durham International Airport's governing board voted recently to purchase 4 buses from manufacturer Proterra. The RDU Airport Authority is using a $1.6 million grant from the Federal Aviation Administration to pay half the cost of the Proterra Catalyst E2 battery electric buses. The news follows an attempt in June by Regional Transit Authority Go Triangle to get 7 electric buses on the streets by 2019. Go Triangle has submitted its own grant paperwork to the Federal Transit Administration for funding to make that happen. Jeff Mann, General Manager of Go Triangle, says recent technology changes have made the buses more viable than ever. Namely, he points to the increased battery range of the vehicles. The town of Chapel Hill is also planning to add 2 electric buses to its fleet. According to John Connell, RDU Vice President of Operational Asset Management, the airport's bus order is the result of 2 years' worth of work by staff. The low bid for buses, infrastructure, and training was $3.4 million. Each bus cost nearly $722,000 compared to $440,000 for a new diesel bus. The chargers alone cost about $380,000 each, and 4 are required for RDU's build-out. While it's just 4 buses today, Connell says, staff will have to consider whether to add more in the future. They're cheaper to maintain, at about half the cost of what the RDU invests in its diesel buses each year, and they're quieter, and should mean a smoother shuttle for passengers. But the cost savings is really what drew us to the electric buses, Connell said. And in a short article about the airport, is the article, International Travel Raises RDU Numbers. Raleigh-Durham International Airport posted what Michael Langeth, CEO of the RDU Airport Authority, referred to as a record July. The airport reported a total of 532,289 departing passengers that month, a 4.7% increase over the same time period last year. More than 18,000 of those passengers were flying internationally, which is a 25.5% increase over last year. Now, here are the top carriers in terms of departing passengers for July, and I'm going to round these to the nearest 1,000 passengers. Delta Airlines with 165,000, American Airlines with 134,000, Southwest Airlines with 112,000, United Airlines with 68,000, and JetBlue with 23,000. Now moving to the technology page, in this week's Triangle Business Journal comes the article on collaboration, Red Hat expanding Microsoft deal. Raleigh open source software firm Red Hat is expanding its existing partnership with Microsoft. The news comes 2 months after Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst told analysts on an earnings call that revenue spinning from that partnership is, quote, growing very, very fast, unquote. The Microsoft partnership expansion announced on August 22nd means more flexibility for enterprise customers. That's according to a joint statement on the deal, which will mean new initiatives aimed at enabling enterprises to easily adopt containers. The alliance includes native support for Windows Server containers on Red Hat OpenShift. Red Hat OpenShift dedicated on Microsoft Azure, an SQL server on Red Hat Enterprise Linux and Red Hat OpenShift. The deal translates to IT flexibility for companies, says Mike Ferris, the Raleigh-based vice president of cloud strategy at Red Hat. As a result, it could mean a revenue boost for both firms. The original partnership focused on hybrid cloud technology, ensuring that companies were working closer together to deliver products, he notes. Now we're talking more aggressively around containers, and the initiatives we're talking about today will make it easier for customers to build and deploy containers, especially as they're leveraging both Microsoft Cloud and Red Hat platforms together, he says. Windows Server containers will be supported inside and by Red Hat's OpenShift technology. A big statement, because we're saying to the market, regardless of whether you're a Windows-based environment or you're a Red Hat Enterprise Linux-based environment, you can use both of those together. And here's an article about a California firm moving to Cary. California firm upbeat about the upcoming shift of headquarters to Cary. 4 months in, and the talent is tremendous, says Trilliant Networks CEO Andy White. His company is in the process of moving its headquarters from California to Cary, a move that, according to what he pledged the state in April, means 130 new Triangle jobs. While the firm doesn't actually move into its permanent headquarters space until August the 28th, the hiring has already started at the clean tech company. So far, 21 people are the part of the Cary team. That includes about 17 new hires from the Triangle. We're probably going to be about 40 by the end of the year, he says, noting that the total 130 job commitment was for the next 5 years. I think we'll get there much faster than that. The ribbon-cutting ceremony with Governor Roy Cooper is September the 7th. That same day, Trilliant is scheduled to have its first board meeting in the new facility. White will spend about a week per month in the Triangle. 80% of the firm's business is international. In April, Trilliant was approved for a JDIG award worth up to $1.3 million in total reimbursements. North Carolina had competition from Colorado, Florida, Georgia, and Tennessee for the product. Now we move to the On Life Sciences page of this week's Triangle Journal. In an expansion note, Avista Pharma CEO expects more hiring in Durham. Avista Pharma Solutions, which acquired the GMP contract manufacturing development and animal health sciences business of Synexus back in 2015, has completed a lab expansion in Durham as the company looks to add between 75 and 100 new employees in the next 12 to 24 months. Since its acquisition of the Synexis unit and subsequent move of its headquarters to Durham, Avista has invested about $24 million in expansion locally, as well as in Longmont, Colorado, and Agawam, Massachusetts. Avista completed its Durham expansion earlier this month in a move that doubled the size of its two labs there, one for analytical research and development and the other for quality control. Avista's capital investment in Durham involved renovating, reconfiguring, and upgrading its existing 92,000 square feet and installing new equipment, says CEO Patrick Walsh. When we acquired the business about 2 years ago, we wanted to see what we could do to achieve greater success, Walsh says. With the Durham lab expansion, Avista has added new capabilities in analytical research and development and bulked up the size of the quality control lab, he says. According to Walsh, Avista has seen a 40% increase to its headcount in Durham since the acquisition of the Synexis unit and establishment of its headquarters in Durham. To date, that has equated to about 30 employees in highly skilled scientific and technical roles and an additional $3.6 million in payroll, he says. Scalability of the lab was important, Walsh says, noting that Avista has tripled its customer base over the last couple of years. It's essential to be very good at delivering on the timelines and expectations of a very demanding client base, he says. Avista is a portfolio company of Ampersand Capital Partners. Its client roster is more than 300 globally and includes virtual biotechnology companies, global pharmaceutical companies, and animal health companies. And in other news from the Life Sciences page comes the article, Blue Cross North Carolina wants to shift 50,000 to ACA plans. About 50,000 Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina customers who've been able to keep their existing health plans since the Affordable Care Act passed in 2010 will have to transition to ACA plans effective January the 1st. Because no new customers have joined this pool since 2010, the group as a whole has gotten older and sicker, BCBSNC stated in a blog post. That means they've also become more expensive to insure. And as the number of customers continues to dwindle, the cost to continue to offer the plan becomes disproportionate. We'd need to raise rates for these customers a significant amount to keep offering these plans in 2018. When we consider all these factors, we determined that December 31, 2017 is the right date to discontinue our grandfathered plans. According to the insurer, the only one offering ACA plans in all of North Carolina's 100 counties in 2018, there were more than 330,000 customers on a grandfathered plan in 2010, but now there are only about 50,000. We made this decision because the plans were popular with the more than 300,000 customers who enrolled in those plans at the time. Today, only about 50,000 customers remain in these plans, an indication that the plan no longer meets the needs of most customers, a spokeswoman for BCBSNC said in an email. We know this discussion will disappoint some customers, and we will work closely with them to help them find a comparable plan that meets the requirements of the Affordable Care Act. Earlier this month, BCBSNC lowered its requested rate increase for ACA plans next year from 22.9% to 14.1%. And in continuing news from the Life Sciences front comes the article, Cary Manufacture at Center of Dueling Patent Lawsuits. Cary-based Loparex LLC, an international company that manufactures silicone release liners for adhesive use, has found itself party to a pair of dueling patent lawsuits. The patent in question is U.S. patent number 7,879,420. For a roofing product described as a multi-layered liner, a multi-layered product which includes the release liner, and a method for making the release liner. On August the 18th, Mondi Group filed suit against Loparex in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois. And on the same day, Loparex filed suit in the U.S. District Court for the Middle District of North Carolina, naming Mondi and a subsidiary as defendants related to the same patent. The dispute in part stems from a 2008 deal in which several Loparex businesses were sold to a subsidiary of Mondi. But Mondi alleges in its complaint that rights to the patent extend prior to the deal. The complaint filed by Mondi alleges that one of Mondi's current employees actually invented the technology before Loparex obtained the patent. Mondi states that years prior to the deal, Loparex was instructed by a client to produce a similar product and that it ultimately obtained a patent for it. According to Loparex's complaint, the technology's three inventors are named on the patent, and they assigned their rights to Loparex OY back in 2005. About a month prior to Loparex OY becoming a subsidiary of Mondi through the 2008 deal, Loparex claims rights to the technology were assigned to Loparex LLC. Loparex alleges that Mondi's claims that the wrong inventors were named on the patent and that it is invalid are false, and that its ownership could be jeopardized or eliminated, and that limitations on Mondi related to practicing the invention could be removed. Loparex announced its headquarters move from Chicago to Cary back in 2009. And in additional news from the life sciences front comes the article, Red Hill Strikes Deal on the GI Drug and Will Share Revenue. Red Hill Biopharma, which recently launched commercial efforts and an ongoing expansion in Raleigh, following the recruitment of a number of former Salix Pharmaceuticals employees, has made another commercial play. The company has inked a new commercialization agreement with Carmel, Indiana-based ParaPro. The terms give Red Hill exclusive rights in certain U.S. territories to promote a treatment of gastroesophageal reflux disease, sometimes called GERD, and other conditions called esomeprazole strontium delayed release capsules. According to Red Hill, the estimated U.S. market value for the product type was more than $20 billion in 2016. We've been looking for additional GI assets for quite some time, says Guy Goldberg, chief business officer of Red Hill. He says the company's sales force had more capacity and that ParaPro was looking for a sales force in the GI space. Red Hill is not required to make upfront or milestone payments per the terms of the agreement, and both companies will share revenue generated from the product's promotion, according to Red Hill. The agreement's initial term is 3 years. In June, Red Hill began promoting two new GI products for irritable bowel syndrome and chronic diarrhea. They're called Donatel and Enteragam. Commercial operations, which are focused only on the U.S., will supply the company with a revenue stream moving forward as Red Hill's pipeline develops. At the beginning of last month, Red Hill reported initial net revenue on the second quarter of 2017. The company said revenue of $500,000 were for the period between June 12th and June 30th, following the start of U.S. promotional activities for Donatel and sale of Enteragam. We're very happy with how things are progressing, says Goldberg, of the efforts to ramp up. And finally, on the life sciences page comes the announcement of a retirement. The BDSI CEO to retire. Mark Sergo, who has served as president and CEO of Raleigh-based BioDelivery Sciences International since 2005, will retire at the end of this year. He will stay on as vice chairman of the company's board of directors, BDSI announced August 23rd. I'm still going to be engaged in the business, but from a very different role, Sergo says. BDSI reacquired pain management product Belbuca from Endo Pharmaceuticals earlier this year. The company has since seen two strong quarters, with a strong third quarter of 2017 expected as well, Sergo says. Sergo says BDSI will look internally and externally for his successor, someone with a strong commercial background and Wall Street experience. Because BDSI is a public company, experience interfacing with investors routinely is desirable, he says. BDSI reported net revenue of roughly $38.2 million for the first half of 2017, compared to $8 million for the first half of 2016. Part of BDSI's reacquisition of Belbuca has involved an increased focus on markets outside of the United States. In June, BDSI announced that Belbuca had received Health Canada approval and that it planned to launch the product there early in 2018. Shortly thereafter, BDSI inked an agreement with Purdue Pharma, that's an organization in Canada, for the licensing and distribution rights of Belbuca in Canada. Also in June, BDSI announced that it had inked an agreement with CVS Caremark that extends access to Belbuca, an opioid dependence product, Bunavail, through 2020. Moving forward, Shergo says, BDSI will look to even stronger efforts in Washington when it comes to policy, lobbying, and education. And in news from around the state comes the article, Concord Manufacturer Files for Bankruptcy. Despite a lot of big promises, battery systems manufacturer Olevo may have foundered on relatively small debt, totaling as little as $20 million, according to its initial bankruptcy filings. Olevo Manufacturing, Inc. and Olevo USA, Inc., the two U.S. subsidiaries of Swiss company, the Olevo Group, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy on August the 18th. Both are based in Concord, where Olevo kept offices and its manufacturing plant at the former Philip Morris manufacturing site. Each list debts in the $10 million to $50 million range. Olevo Manufacturing listed assets in the same range, but Olevo USA says its assets are less, totaling $1 million to $10 million. The largest single creditor for both is Matthews-based Century Contractors, which is owed more than $2.2 million by Olevo Manufacturing. The only other creditor owed more than $1 million by either subsidiary is Olantum Advanced Technology Materials of Dalian City, China, which is owed $1.02 million by Olevo Manufacturing. More detailed filings in the future will lay out the full debt and asset picture for the company. The cases are filed with the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Middle District of North Carolina, based in Greensboro. The company started operation in Chicago in 2014 with enormous fanfare and a promise of 2,500 jobs when the plant went into full production. It never got close. It had 290 employees at Concord when it closed. All but 45 have been laid off. Those workers will remain at the plant through September as the company closes shop in preparation for liquidation of its assets. Olevo has struggled to produce the 2-megawatt utility-scale batteries housed in 40-foot tractor-trailer carriers that were central to the battery system it sought to market. More than 3 years after opening, it had only a single production line and little actual production. Only one battery, installed in March for the municipal utility of Hagerstown, Maryland, had been delivered. And finally, here's an interesting article about Hanes. Hanes turns to Justin Bieber to promote a t-shirt. Pop star Justin Bieber is the face of a new Hanes brand t-shirt collection. The singer teamed up with the Winston-Salem-based company to create Hanes X Carla, which features a modern take on the classic t-shirt. Hilton Graham, head of collaborations for the Hanes brand, says Bieber is featured wearing the t-shirts in billboards in large markets as part of a larger effort by the iconic brand that's been around since 1901. We're trying to remind people all the time that Hanes is much more than that. We can be classic and fashionable, Graham says. The concept created by Carla Welch, Bieber's stylist, who had been buying large Hanes t-shirts and creating a new style for the star. What came out of it was this long-length t-shirt that's below the waist, Graham says. It's a totally different shape. He started wearing it on stage during the Purpose tour. And now for today's article on the cover story entitled Unintended Consequence. 7 years ago, there were almost 2,600 personal bankruptcy filed in Wake County. By last year, that number had dropped by 40% to just 1,537. It's the same trend in neighboring Durham County and across North Carolina and the United States. And while the reasons are many and complex, one clear driver is the Affordable Care Act, signed into law in 2010. Raleigh attorney William Brewer, who has practiced for four decades and specializes in bankruptcy, says the ACA's impact on the drop in personal bankruptcies makes a fair amount of sense. If more people are insured and have a party to pay their medical bills, It makes sense that the number of people filing for bankruptcy decreases, he said. Since 2010, personal bankruptcy filings have declined each year at a national level. The number of filings exploded to more than 1.5 million in 2010, according to the American Bankruptcy Institute, sometimes called the ABI. By 2016, that number had dropped to 770,846, almost a 50% decrease. Over the same period, North Carolina saw a decrease of about 44% in the number of total bankruptcy, a trend that is rippling across the healthcare industry. WakeMed in Raleigh, for example, is seeing a decrease in bankruptcy claims. And in Durham County, there were 760 personal filings in 2010, compared to just 457 in 2016. With medical debt a massive driver of personal bankruptcies, and about 20 million more Americans insured as a result of the ACA, a potential repeal could send medical debt soaring back up and the personal bankruptcy decline into a tailspin. Medical issues, whether directly or indirectly, are among the main reasons people file for bankruptcy, says Brewer. Medical issues could include someone's own or having to stay at home to care for someone else, both of which may involve job loss. All of those factor into loss of income and inability to pay various forms of debt, and therefore the need for debt relief, he says. One professor who has studied bankruptcy closely, Michael Souza of the University of Denver Sturm College of Law, put it bluntly, health care insurance matters. The plan behind the ACA was improved access to health care, but often the notion of improved financial security gets overlooked. Health care is also a source of financial security and insecurity, says Jonathan Oberlander, professor of the Department of Social Medicine and professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at UNC Chapel Hill. To the extent that 20 million people have gained coverage, there's been a measurable increase in financial security related to the ACA, he says, noting that Medicaid expansion has been a big driver. And according to a May policy note from the North Carolina Hospital Association, those without insurance coverage are more likely to delay or ignore preventive health care, which leads to expensive, uncoordinated care and fails to address chronic issues that are better managed in a primary care setting. Brewer says the ACA and the attempt to approach universal health coverage is designed to encourage more preventive health care, seeking care outside of just when a person is sick. An increase in preventive care is likely to reduce developing long-term illnesses, becoming disabled, and being out of work, he says. That, in turn, aids in decreasing bankruptcies. Access and financial security, as benefits of the ACA, are intertwined, and both have the capacity to drive down medical debt and bankruptcy. Total bankruptcies, like personal bankruptcies, have dropped in North Carolina since 2010. In 2010, there were 26,674 total bankruptcies filed in the state. That number dropped every year after, ultimately to 14,899 in 2016, a drop of 44%. Total Chapter 7 filings in North Carolina dropped about 58% over the same period, from 14,352 in 2010 to just 6,000 in 2016. Bankruptcy numbers are impacted by multiple factors. The passage of a federal bankruptcy law in 2005 made it more difficult to file for bankruptcy. The economy has improved since the Great Recession, and ACA provisions did not take full effect until the beginning of 2014. But still, those who track bankruptcies closely cite an undeniable decline following the ACA's implementation. According to the CDC's most recent National Health Interview Survey, the percentage of persons under age 65 who were in families having problems paying medical bills decreased from 21.3% in 2011 to 16.2% in the first 6 months of 2016. A Harvard Law School study, co-authored by current U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, and published in 2009, found that medical debt accounted for more than 60% of bankruptcies. Professor Souza of the University of Denver and Brooke Gottberg of the University of Missouri School of Law or the principal researchers for a new study being commissioned by ABI to look at whether the expansion of Medicaid through the ACA has had a correlative effect on personal bankruptcy filings. While the study is still ongoing, data collected so far has shown that those who had a lapse in their health insurance coverage are 3 times more likely to file for bankruptcy, says Gottberg. A lapse in health insurance coverage, she says, can have a catastrophic effect and push people into bankruptcy. In looking at 3 groups, those that don't have any health insurance, those that have insurance, and those that have lapsed, it would be easy to assume that those who don't have insurance would be the group that rises to the top in terms of bankruptcies. But instead, it's the lapsed group. That cohort is likely to have characteristics similar to the group without insurance. Lower income and lower number of weeks worked, notes Gottberg, but also more likely to have a health limitation, she says. If the health limitation has caused those in the lapsed group to be out of work and lose health care coverage, these factors, along with a lower income and fewer number of weeks worked, can all lead to bankruptcy, says Gottberg. Is the trend short-lived? Even with the decline of personal bankruptcy following the ACA, the fact remains that many Americans still struggle with medical debt. Some of the people who are buying private policies on the healthcare marketplace are buying policies with pretty high deductibles, says Oberlander. Julie Henry, Vice President of Communications of the North Carolina Hospital Association, echoes that sentiment. Since the ACA was signed into law, Henry says the NCHA has seen that individuals are taking more time to evaluate and investigate how much treatment is going to cost in advance, and perhaps some people are rationing their own care. For the newly insured, those that have not had health insurance before, finding out at the time of treatment that there is still a copay, for instance, is a lot of money out of pocket, she says. We've seen charity care go down and more people insured since the ACA, but we've also seen debt creep back, says Henry. This is largely related to people not being able to pay their bills as a result of high deductible plans. Those high deductible plans, Oberlander says, remain a concern. There's still a lot of Americans having trouble paying medical debt, he says. Crisis care, as a result of putting off preventive care, is incredibly costly to a point that people generally can't afford, Henry says. Overall, the intention was good, she says, of the ACA, but the implementation has not worked out as well as people would have hoped. Dr. Jane Bryce, chair of emergency medicine at UNC Hospitals, says the self-pay rate at her hospital was 27% before former President Barack Obama took office. Now, in case you don't know, self-pay patients are those who are uninsured and often can't pay at all. When we passed Obamacare, our self-pay rate fell to somewhere around 20 to 1 or 22%. So we anticipated that it would continue to drop off, she says, adding, now all of that is up in the air. The future of the ACA moving forward remains uncertain as the healthcare industry waits and watches. The Senate bill, according to the Congressional Budget Office, would have increased the number of uninsured by 22 million by 2026. According to a May policy note from the NCHA, since 2010, North Carolina has seen a 33% reduction in the number of uninsured residents. The note goes on to state that the American Hospital Association reports that a loss of coverage for the newly insured would result in $165.8 billion in increased hospital uncompensated care and lower utilization nationwide. If people lose access to insurance that they can afford, then what we'll see is people not getting preventive care that they need, says Henry. That situation equates to crisis care, which is always more expensive. We would like to see some things tweaked rather than abandoning the ACA altogether, she said. UNC's Oberlander echoes the concern about having millions lose insurance. A repeal would have a devastating impact on medical bankruptcy, he says. Ann Raleigh, attorney Brewer, who has watched the ebb and flow of bankruptcies for decades, knows that he'll be one of those looking to help those facing soaring medical bills and unable to pay. The more that people who are not covered by insurance incur medical debt that they are legally obligated to pay themselves, he says, it will increase the number of bankruptcies. Now we move to this week's column executive voice, featuring David Swain. David Swain's a real estate developer. He has family, a wife, Diane, and a daughter and son. His education has a BS and BA in business from UNC Chapel Hill. His first job growing up was working on the loading docks, packing and unpacking 18-wheelers during the hot summer months. So here's the Q&A with David Swain. You grew up in a small town outside Winston-Salem. How did you get involved in real estate development? My mom was a school teacher, and my dad was a manager of a 7-Up bottling plant. Dad died when I was little, and my mom worked extra hard to raise my brother and me. I was most fortunate to have had the chance to go to UNC Chapel Hill, and when I graduated, I was offered a job with a life insurance company called Intagon Life in Winston-Salem. I was eventually assigned to do a project for the president of the company. He was pleased with the way the project went and asked me what part of the company interested me the most. I told him that real estate seemed interesting, and so he moved me to that division, where I began to learn how to analyze investment-grade properties. My duties entailed producing loans on shopping centers, office buildings, and industrial properties. I was about 20 years old, and my territory was Washington, D.C. to Miami. For a guy from Walkertown, population 700, who had only flown on an airplane to interview for jobs, this was the big time. I spent most of my days on the road evaluating real estate up and down the East Coast. This time in my career was invaluable because I got to see firsthand the differences between good and bad real estate, good and bad developers, and good and bad developments. So how did you get into real estate development full-time? After several years at Intagon, I had a chance to work with a residential developer in Mount Airy. I was about 23. He was about 70. We became best of friends, and I spent a couple of years with him learning how to build fairly large residential projects. We would build about 200 single-family homes per year. One day, I received a marketing flyer in the mail advertising a seminar on developing apartments. On a whim, we decided to go hear the pitch, which was delivered by the head of the housing authority in New Jersey. The program intrigued me, and so I decided to do a little more homework. Within a year, I felt that I'd figured out the opportunity, and so for the first time, I invested my own money in a project. I was about 25 years old. The deal was a 24-unit apartment complex and cost $1.5 million. The project went well, and over the next 5 years, I developed 48 more complexes in small towns around North Carolina. So why did you and your wife settle in Wilmington? When my wife and I turned 40, we were living in Mount Airy, which is a pretty small town in the mountains. Our children were little, and we decided a move would be an exciting change of pace. We both agreed we didn't want to move to a large city, and we wanted to be near the coast. We had built a house at Sunset Beach and really liked it there. It was obvious Wilmington had a bright future, and after several visits, I thought I could make a contribution to the growth of the community. On one of my trips to look at the area, a broker drove me to a new community called Landfall. The lots had just been platted and were reasonably priced, so I bought one on the spot and used the phone in the sales office to call Diane to tell her the news. So how do you decide which charities and community programs to support? When we are trying to determine how to use our resources for good, we generally ask four questions. 1. Do we believe in the organization's missions? 2. Are their goals attainable? 3. Does their success perpetuate itself? 4. Does our participation help them make a noticeable difference? If the answers are yes, then we are likely to lend our support. How did the vision for CenterPoint come about? I've lived in Wilmington now for 28 years, and the property I'm buying from the Wetherill family has been number one on my list of great sites for about 22 of those years. It really is a wonderful piece of property that sits along two major thoroughfares and is effectively the gateway to Wrightsville Beach. While I've admired the property for a long time, only recently have the stars aligned to make a development like CenterPoint possible. Specifically, in March of 2016, Wilmington City Council adopted the Create Wilmington Comprehensive Plan that set the tone for what future development in the city should look like. The new plan emphasizes the need for a more modern approach to development and facilitates making projects more urban, efficient, and, in my opinion, more exciting. This has enabled us to think big, be innovative, and really plan an immersive environment where people can live, work, and play without ever having to leave the development. Ultimately, my goal is to make Centerpoint a real showplace. When we finish, I want it to be known throughout North Carolina as a first-class project. More importantly, though, I want it to be the pride of our city, county, and region for the next 50 years. Finally, have you started thinking about plans for retirement and a succession plan? I don't know that I'll ever retire. I love what I do too much. But yes, we've been planning for the future of the company for the past 20 years. I have surrounded myself with the smartest and most creative group of people in my industry. They live and breathe real estate and truly enjoy what they do. Our team takes great pride in all that we accomplish together. As long as I can dream big, surround myself with amazing people, and feel like I'm making a difference in the communities where we work, I'll keep on showing up at the office. Now comes an article on family business, and the article is entitled How Success Can Threaten Any Business. If you sat down to list the greatest hazards faced by family-owned businesses today, you'd probably begin with the old standards: internal family conflict, inadequate planning, government regulations, and economic uncertainty. But you might not register one potential hazard that can blow a family business right out of the water: success. What makes success so threatening to a family business? Usually it's the shock of the transformation from a one- or two-person operation to a larger and more complex company. On the management side, if systems and controls aren't upgraded to meet the demands of increased business volume, unpleasant things begin to happen. Operations get sluggish, then unresponsive, then downright unworkable. The next thing you know, customers are bailing out as the whole shebang goes into a dive. On the human side, success usually means that the informality so characteristic of smaller, entrepreneurial, and family-owned businesses has to give way to structure and accountability. Family and non-family employees have to have job descriptions, even titles. Hiring with a handshake and firing with best wishes for the future doesn't cut it anymore, and word-of-mouth marketing no longer brings in enough business to sustain the bigger organization. When a family business succeeds, its character can't be so easily defined by the senior owner's personality, quirks, and preferences. Sure, old Huey's grinning mug still decorates the big sign in front of the store. But when the business has grown from $300,000 per year to $3 million, the bankers who capitalize the expansion are not amused by Huey closing the store for the NCAA basketball tournament. Success tends to force the realization that the business is no longer a vest pocket enterprise. A booming company needs the best management talent it can afford, even if it has to come from the outside. So should family businesses eye the prospect of success like a Transylvania maiden eyeing Count Dracula? Certainly not. But smart families should always be ready to adapt to significant change, including the change that comes with success. Now we move to the viewpoint page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and from the editor's notebook comes the article, Quail Hollow and Sedgefield Show Their Strengths and Flaws. It was a big golf month for the state of North Carolina. First, Charlotte's Quail Hollow Club played host to a major golf tournament championship. The PGA Championship, followed by Greensboro hosting the annual PGA Tour's final regular season tournament, the Wyndham Championship at Sedgefield Country Club. As luck would have it, I went to both events but came back with totally different experiences. Being a hacker myself, I enjoyed seeing professional golfers make clutch shots and get out of trouble with shots I can only execute in my dreams. But perhaps more importantly, I wanted to absorb the fan experience at the event, something you won't know unless you attend. First, golf. As advertised, Quail Hollow was a beast of a course. When almost the entire field struggled to make the cut and often shook their heads after hitting shots, you knew the course was playing uber tough. In fact, while walking alongside Rory McIlroy and Ricky Fowler on one of the holes, I could hear McIlroy talking to his caddy about the uncertainty the course offers if the ball's not on the fairway. That's probably true of any championship course, but Quail Hollow really made people pay for stray shots. In the end, only 12 players broke par. At Sedgefield, the course was much different. While the rough was tough on the players, and many of the Donald Ross-created undulated greens were a problem, the shorter length of the course made things fairly easy for most pros. In comparison, Quail Hollow played 7,600 yards long, wet. Ultimately, Justin Thomas of the U.S. won the PGA Championship at 8 under par, and Henrik Stenson of Sweden won the Wyndham at 22 under par. So Quail Hollow was the winner when it comes to testing the players, hands down. Second, fan experience. While there are several signs pointing to parking as you approach Quail Hollow, the signs were far from helpful. Volunteers at two lots asked us to find other lots because they were full. This was at 10:30 a.m. on a Friday. Can't imagine how it was on the weekend. Finally, we found a church lot that charged us $30, but a shuttle service dropped us off near the bus terminal at the course. The bleachers baked in the sun most of the day, and as expected, there were long lines for food and drinks. The most pleasant part of the fan experience? The PGA merchandise store. Seldom have I seen such efficiency when it comes to checkout lines. There must have been 200 people in front of us when we got into the checkout line. It took us about 7 minutes to be in front of the clerk. The PGA had it down when it came to helping us thin our wallets in seemingly record time. The experience at Sedgefield was something else. We parked at one of the premier lots 7 minutes from the course and paid $15 for the shuttle ride that came to pick us up about 2 minutes after we got in line. Once there, it was clear that Wyndham had a far smaller crowd than the PGA Championship for obvious reasons, but that didn't stop the volunteers from being extra helpful to the patrons. When we needed Advil, a volunteer assisted us to the first aid mobile unit. When a fan wanted a shh sign after the end of the tournament, a smiling volunteer obliged. For people who have never been to a golf tournament, volunteers use these signs to stop people from yapping when a player gets ready to hit a shot. Maybe it was the size of the tournament, but I found the Wyndham volunteers friendlier. It certainly isn't a Charlotte versus Greensboro thing, I hope. So I'm chalking that up to the volunteers being overwhelmed at Quail Hollow. Regardless, Sedgefield wins the Fan Experience Award. Well, that music indicates we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. 5138.